Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are 9 days past the 2018 midterm elections, and the numbers keep rolling in, bolstering a Democratic takeover of the House of Representatives and staunching their losses in the Senate. Meanwhile, the president was off and running, immediately trashing the media that covers him before dashing overseas to commemorate the 100-year anniversary of the end of World War I. Joining us to make some sense of it all is longtime political analyst and former NPR political editor Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. We'll post a link to Ken's podcast at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome back, Ken.
And I'm here to make sense of it all.
Well, I like to raise the bar for you, Ken.
I think we need to go to a bar after this election.
No kidding.
My goodness.
I kind of wondered, stupidly, what would Ken and I talk about 9 days after the midterm elections?
Well, they're still counting, and that's what's so remarkable. Yeah. I mean, it shouldn't be remarkable, but you're not going to believe this because something has happened that's never happened before in American politics. There's a recount in Florida. I don't know if you've ever heard. Who knew, right? But my goodness, the thing that's going on in Florida, Republicans still have leads in both the Senate and gubernatorial contest, and those leads may still hold up, mm-hmm. but there are still problems in Broward County. There are still problems in Palm Beach County. There are antiquated machines that are still breaking down. There are still voting law restrictions that if your signature doesn't match with your driver's license, like, I mean, who signs their name anymore because everything is just so digitized? Mm-hmm. So nobody uses a pen anymore. And a lot of people have been turned away from the polls because their signatures didn't match what was on their voter registration slip. So there are so many questions about who's eligible, who's able to count votes. And I would like to think that both parties, if they agree on anything, it's that every vote should count. And so even though the deadline today is today in Florida for the recount, and counties mm-hmm. need to have their numbers in by late this afternoon, that may be extended because of all these irregularities. And again, it doesn't seem like we've learned much from 2000.
18 years later, can you believe it?
Right. I know. You know, I'm just thinking of the people who were born in 2000 and they're just getting to vote now. They have no memory of what that was. And that was, I mean, you think of memorable election nights. I mean, not yeah. only were we up at NPR until 5 in the morning trying to decipher what happened, but it wasn't until mid-December until finally the Supreme Court ruled against the Florida Supreme Court and said the recounts have to stop. And then Al Gore conceded and George W. Bush was elected president.
You know, so much of how we operate in this country when it comes to our democracy depends on our faith in the system. And before 2000, you know, you and I grew up with sort of this palpable faith. I mean, it was clear that we had the best system in the world. That's what we kept telling everybody. And that's what we were told. And since then, 18 years later, it seems to be more and more fallible.
Although, let's be honest, you and I grew up in a sad time following the McKinley assassination. So those were bad times. There's no question about that. But having said that, you're absolutely right. Not only have many people been turned off to what happened in 2000 because basically it wasn't 536 votes in Florida. It was a 5-4 Supreme Court decision that, you know, if you're a Republican, you liked it. If you're a Democrat, you were disheartened. But now it's even worse, I think, in Florida. Not as much is at stake. It's obviously we're just talking about a Senate seat and a gubernatorial seat. But there are people in this country who are saying that they're stealing the election. It's fraud. It's illegal. They should go to, you know, lock them up. And when you just completely turn people off to the sanctity of democracy or, you know, turn them off and, you know, turn them against when you start making the case that democracy no longer works and voting cannot be trusted, you're saying something about, you know, democratic ideals in this country. It's very, very disheartening to hear people day in and day out saying it's a fraud, it's fake, they're trying to steal the election.
With no evidence.
With no evidence. That's exactly right.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking post midterm 2018 elections with Ken Rudin, longtime political analyst, former NPR political editor, and host of the Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. In Ohio, where every statewide executive office remained Republican, white, and male, the Columbus Dispatch on Sunday said that the governor-elect Mike DeWine had harnessed the quote-unquote Trump effect. What do you make of the GOP success in Ohio?
Well, you know, something we talk about, you know, the 2018 being the year of the woman and the Democratic blue wave, and neither happened in Ohio. I think people in talking about what a great night last Tuesday was for the Democrats, they overlook what happened for Ohio, for the Republicans in Ohio, and that was a key race, a key contest, especially in the race for governor. Did Mike DeWine win overwhelmingly? No, he got 50.7% of the vote, but still, having said that, given the fact that the 2020 redistricting is coming up soon when they redraw all the districts, and remember, since 2012, Ohio has been the same in the congressional elections every 2 years, 12 Republicans, 4 Democrats. The Democrats desperately needed a Democratic governor and a Democratic legislature to redraw the lines. Now, of course, there is now a new commission in Ohio that may be able to do that. But my goodness, you think of all the blue. I'm looking at a map right now of the country, and I see a gigantic sea of red. An increasing sea of blue around congressional races and gubernatorial seats around the country, but not in Ohio.
I concluded the next day, Ken, that Ohio is effectively a red state now. It's not, it doesn't seem purple anymore.
You know something, who knows? I mean, Barack Obama carried the state twice. They were talking about, I mean, once upon a time, I mean, Mitt Romney just, you know, and John McCain, these are the kind of Republicans who usually win in Ohio,
right.
And they got you know, knocked out in 2008, 2012. So, look, remember, this is the only way I can describe it, but I go back to like 1972, Richard Nixon won 49 states, and it was going to be Republican rule forever. And 2 years later was Watergate with a tremendous Democratic comeback in the House. Think of 1992 with a huge Democratic win with Bill Clinton. Young people, women, blacks, Latinos, unions, all were part of a coalition that would elect Bill Clinton and keep the Democrats in power for a long time. And then 2 years later was Newt Gingrich and the Republican Revolution. So every time you think, well, you know something, Ohio is definitely blue or definitely red or whatever, something can change in the next 2 years that, you know, throw out all the conventional wisdom of the previous 2 years. But I agree with you right now. Ohio does seem incredibly red. No changes at all. There were two House races that everybody was looking at with Steve Chabot in Cincinnati and Troy Balderson, you know, the new T-Berry seat in Columbus, and both of them won pretty comfortably for the Republicans. So there was no change. There was no evidence of tired of Donald Trump. I mean, you did have Sherrod Brown. The next president of the United States, by the way. Sure, or at least he thinks so.
Well, wait a minute. What about that other guy?
What other guy?
Right.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
But he's talking about it. But I'm saying that aside from Sherrod Brown, who also won by 8 points, which is the same amount of percentage that Donald Trump won the state by, it was a very good day for the Republicans in the Buckeye State.
You know, looking forward now, while people's minds are riveted on the 2018 midterms, it's worth noting that 2 years from now, there are a lot more Republicans up for re-election in the Senate than there are Democrats. So now, of course, Cory Booker might not be running for re-election because he might be running for something else, but that could change things a lot.
That's true. I mean, look, obviously the reason there were so many Democratic seats up in 2018 is because they did so well in 2012, 6 years prior. Mm-hmm. So of the 35 Senate seats that were up this year, 26 were held by Democrats, which meant that the Republicans had much more targets. The Democrats had much more, many more vulnerable seats. But even before we get to 2020, the Democrats didn't do as poorly as we thought they might do in the Senate. Because, yes, the Republicans picked up three, which was no surprise, North Dakota, Missouri, and Indiana. They may pick up a fourth in Florida, which is my guess. Mm. But the Democrats surprised a lot of people by winning not only in Nevada, but winning in Arizona, mm-hmm. the Jeff Flake seat, with the first Democrat to win a Senate seat there. Kyrsten Sinema, since 1988, 30 years, they haven't elected a Democrat to the Senate yet. And also, going back to the bigger picture, the Democrat, you think, well, you know, I remember on the election night we said, well, you know, it was a good night. It was kind of a mixed bag. The Democrats did well in the House, but the Republicans did well in the Senate. Mm-hmm. But as you said in your introduction, the more every day there are more and more races called on in Democrats' favor, and it's the biggest Democratic night since 1974 midterm during Watergate. So they picked up 34 seats so far. They're leading in at least three others. They could come very close to 40 seats. Mm-hmm. And if you want the definition of a blue wave, I would say that is the definition of a blue wave.
And the close races were down south, not in Ohio, like they were expected.
Well, yeah, exactly. I thought, as I said, I thought the Cincinnati and Columbus seats were really going to be much closer than they were. But you're right. Two Republicans or three Republicans were knocked out in Texas. Three Republican incumbents were beaten in Virginia. Two or three seats in Florida were knocked out. Newt Gingrich's House seat, which I didn't see happening at all. Mm-hmm. Newt Gingrich's former House seat in the suburbs of Atlanta went for a Democrat for the first time since 1978. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a lot of changes, and who knows what's going to happen later this month in the Mississippi runoff, which hasn't elected a Democrat to the Senate since, I think, 1982. But, I mean, there's a runoff there in the Senate race there with an African-American Democratic candidate and a white Republican. That's something to watch as well.
Yeah, I mean, it tells you that the demographics are changing down south, and the demographics are changing up north, too. I mean, Ohio's getting older, it's an aging, whereas there's more of a youth movement in the South. Do you think that's a part of the story?
Well, that's part of it. Absolutely true. But also, take a look at what's going on in the House writ large. I mean, if you look at the there are two Muslim Americans, female Muslim Americans in the House for the first time ever, one in Michigan, one in Minnesota.
Right.
There are more people of color than we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Over 100 women in the House, which is an all-time record. Now, of course, that's still only one quarter, or less than one quarter of the entire House, but I guess, you know, progress is progress.
Yeah, women have learned to take it when they can get it. My guest is Ken Rudin, a longtime political analyst, host of the Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. He joins us, all things being equal, the third Thursday of every month. If you have a question or comment for Ken Rudin, we're talking about the midterms right now. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@WOSU.org. And you can always post on Facebook as well. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We are talking politics today with the host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to talk about the Georgia race. Ken Rudin, in a speech Wednesday to Al Sharpton's National Action Network, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, who was, of course, reelected last week, commented on remaining midterms.
We also will never give in, as Senator Cardin said, we'll never give in on voting rights. We have seen what, if Stacey Abrams doesn't win in Georgia, they stole it. It's clear. And I would say, I say that publicly, it's clear. What they're trying to do in Florida to the gubernatorial candidate and to the Senate candidate running for re-election. What they tried to do in Ohio with some success by voter purging. What they did in Georgia when they shut down rural precincts that were predominantly African Americans, where many people simply don't have transportation to get to the polls. That's what they do.
Okay, that was abrupt. but the Stacey Abrams race, the gubernatorial race in Georgia is the vitriol now flying back and forth, the lawsuits being filed. What do you make of that race and what happens in the end?
Well, you mentioned the word race, and I think race has a lot to do with it. I don't want to be, you know, an alarmist here, but let me tell you what my understanding is. First of all, the Republican candidate is Brian Kemp, who until election night was the Secretary of State. So he was the person responsible for overseeing the way elections are run in Georgia. He's a white Republican. The Democratic candidate was Stacey Abrams, who is African-American, hoping to be not only the first African-American governor of Georgia, but the first female African-American governor in the country's history. Anyway, the accusations all along had been that Brian Kemp was, in the way he was overseeing voter registration, he would disqualify tens of thousands of voting applications because they didn't, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's. And many Democrats have said that Kemp is basically trying to disenfranchise many voters who the majority, the overwhelming majority of which are African American. So this has been a complaint by the Democrats all along. So right now, the vitriol is uncanny. The Republicans, we heard Sherrod Brown, both parties are talking about stolen elections. And there's some truth to some accusations in the fact that many African American voters have been disenfranchised. And we've seen states around the country putting up roadblocks to make it more and more difficult to vote. I mean, I don't care what your ideology is. I don't care what your positions are. But I would make the argument that having the largest number of people voting is exactly what democracy is all about. So having said that, right now, Stacey Abrams seems to be 58,000 votes behind Brian Kemp in the count. I mean, again, the Democrats are still saying that there are so many people who have been illegally disenfranchised. Stacey Abrams is not going to overtake his lead right now, but if they can get his numbers down to under 50%, because Georgia has a law, Georgia is one of two states that has a law that basically if a candidate doesn't get 50% of the vote, they automatically go to a runoff, and the runoff would be early December. So whatever Stacey Abrams and her team can do, it's not to really erase the 58,000 vote lead. It's enough recounting, or at least counting all the incoming, you know, the mail-in ballots and the provisional ballots to put him under 50%. If that's the case, then the two go to a runoff in December. Otherwise, she loses.
I've got a couple callers, Ken, who want to talk about terminology and talking about politics. First, Francis in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Francis.
Hi. My question is, I keep hearing about conservative, far right, liberal, far left, progressive. What do these terms actually mean?
Well, that's great. I mean, I love that question because once upon a time, the left of center Democrats like to be called liberals. And then I don't know if it began with Joe McCarthy, if it went on with Richard Nixon, whatever it was, but liberal became a word they tried to shy away from. So many liberal Democrats now call themselves progressives because it's more a positive word. You're progressing towards something. But basically it's still there. I think that, Francis, one of your biggest theme about your question is that there is no longer a middle anymore. once upon a time, they were, both parties would have people who were safely in the middle, who tried to reach out to voters on both sides. Now we see people like, you know, either Jeff Flake or Mark Sanford on the right, or Joe Lieberman among the Democrats. When you start talking across party aisles, you get challenged by the ideologues in your own party from the left or the right. So there's not much of a center anymore. But conservatives, you know, I mean, far right is probably said by somebody who's a liberal or somebody left of center, and far left is somebody who's a conservative. A progressive might be seen as a progressive by somebody who's a liberal, and then seen as a far left person by somebody who disagrees with them. It's right. All about how you see it. It's us against them. A lot of politics is us against them. If you're far left or far right, it's obviously a charge being made by somebody who is a complete opposite of where you are.
But it's pretty easy nowadays, Ken, to just go online and look up where they stand on the issues. There's lots of voter guides out there.
Yes and no. I mean, look, there are some people. I mean, I'm trying to think of a good example. There are a lot of Republicans who feel that John Kasich, who's just, you know, is a squish, is saw, you know, a Republican in name only, a moderate, liberal. And there are some Democrats who said, oh, my God, John Kasich is very, very, very conservative. So it all, you know, you can look at the same voting records, the same decisions made in public office, and come up with two completely different conclusions about where they are on the ideological spectrum.
Right. But I think the point I'm making is don't take somebody else's word for it.
Yes.
As political consumers out there, you've got to go and do the research.
Right. And you don't need to come away. You don't have to know if somebody is far left or far right or liberal or conservative. Just see if that person's voting record or positions you agree with or you don't agree with. But we don't have to resort to labels. But unfortunately, that's, you know, with cable TV and the kind of the clever campaign advertising folks out there, using labels is very effective.
Let's see. James in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, James.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, thanks.
I love it. Ken, you've got to talk to the committee or do something. The Democrats are great, but their messaging is you have to dumb it down. You have to talk to plain people. We can't be too idealistic and, oh, well, this guy, and this basic. Hey, this guy said that this day he's going to take your health care. You know, 49 Republican senators voted against health care, including this guy right here. You have to speak to people's primal fears. They're afraid of losing or not having enough. And it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, because ABC, NBC, they all ran ads where the Republicans were going to take the health care. Okay. Everybody was going bananas.
Okay. Well, so, James, let's see what Ken has to say about that. Ken, what about the messaging in the midterms?
Well, you know something, we always talk about how the Republicans are split between Donald Trump and never Trumps. Of course, there are far more Trump supporters in the Republican Party than never Trump Republicans, I think, for all the talk about John Kasich or anybody else who may challenge the president in 2020. I think Republicans are by and large strong supporters of the president. But I think what James is saying is a good point in the fact that the Democrats really don't have a consistent message either. They don't know how to handle, what to do. Do you campaign against Donald Trump, call for the impeachment, call for more investigations? Or do you say that, you know, we need to, now that we have the House, we need to do things that the country wants, like immigration overhaul or infrastructure fixing or climate change or things like that the Democrats believe in. And the fact is the Republicans, both parties play games. I think there are a lot of Democrats who appeal to, well, I'm not saying, let me just put it another way. There are Republicans, for example, we saw a lot of Republicans during the election talk about, I will guarantee the right for pre-existing conditions in healthcare. I am a fighter for that. And yet these same Republicans voted for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which guarantees pre-existing conditions. So you have to keep both parties to their word. You have to make sure they know their records. But as far as strategies for what the Democrats need to do, I don't think they are on the same page at all. And one perfect example is they don't even know what to do with Nancy Pelosi.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy Pelosi, look, yes, she's 78 years old. Yes, she's led the Democrats for 15 years in the House. But the Democrats just came off a gigantic victory. Do you punish the only woman in congressional leadership for doing so well? So both parties need to understand what message they want to bring to the voters as we're approaching 2020. 2020 is just around the corner.
That's for sure. James, thanks a lot for that call. Robin in Grove City, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Robin.
Hi. How do you find someone's voting record?
Well, actually, that's easier than you think. I think certainly public radio has done studies. The League of Women Voters have done voters' guides. I think almost every city and state have a League of Women Voters,
mm-hmm.
who will tell you how your representative or senator or local official has voted. And you could determine by that. But sometimes the bills they vote on themselves can be misinterpreted or interpreted many different ways. It's not always clear. But that should be, you know, if you have some questions, you could send me a note and I could give you specific places where to go. But for the most part, that information is pretty much readily available.
And also, if you feel, if certain issues are important to you, there's whatever groups represent those issues. Keep track as well, right? I mean,
yeah, but sometimes when you have a special interest, you may skew some votes a certain way. So I wouldn't mm-hmm. always go to, like, for example, either a liberal or a conservative organization,
yeah.
and so try to find out what their voting record is. I mean, I've seen the NRA, for example, classify people as anti-gun when these officials say they are not anti-gun. They're just for example, common sense gun efforts. So what these groups do may not be exactly
accurate. The Columbus Dispatch, and this is true of a lot of papers across the country, even though they're, going belly up all over the place, they're still providing their voters' guides free of charge to anybody, subscribers or not. These are a lot of ways to avail yourself of knowledge about people who are running for office and for people who already hold public office. Let's see. Turn to Mort in Westerville. You're on the air. Hi, Mort.
Mort just hold one quick second?
Sure.
One more thing about what Robin said is, Washington Post and I think other newspapers have fact checkers.
Yeah.
And they will report their findings every day. But seems like people don't even care who's telling the truth anymore because everything seems to go. But okay, gripe I'll worry about later.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mort.
Yeah, Mort in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Mort.
Yes, I have a specific question for Ken. Recognizing that in the past attempts to form a middle party have not been successful, does he think that possibly what we really need is a left-of-center and a right-of-center party?
Well, that's exactly what you've wound up with. I mean, if you look at what's going on in politics, there's not much of a center anymore. Now, you may disagree and say that some people who think that the Republican Party in the House is very conservative, and others will say they're not conservative enough, and maybe progressives may say the same thing about the Democrats, not liberal enough. But I think that the two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, are more to the left and more to the right than they've been in any time in my lifetime. They used to be, members, and I think redistricting has a lot to do with that. Right now, they, in the old days, they used to have, like, a district would be 53% one party and 47% the other party. And so, therefore, the incumbent would have to work across party lines to assemble a coalition. Now, with 90% Republican districts and 90% Democratic districts, mm-hmm. they don't have to, there's no need to compromise. So I kind of think that, given the fact there are threats of challenges from the hardline conservatives and liberals and primaries, I think the party are further away from the center than ever before.
Mort, thanks a lot for that call. Let's see. Chris in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my comment kind of goes back to I think it was two callers ago, talking about how do you find voter records. And I think understanding how an elected official voted in the past is the first step, mm-hmm. sort of understanding where they fall on the issues. But you have to peel back the layers to understand why that elected official voted in that certain way. I think a lot of the messaging that we see is that, you know, Republicans voted against health care. They voted to take away pre-existing conditions. But if you look at why they may have voted that way, it's because of maybe budgetary concerns or other constructive issues with the law. You know, the federal deficit is incredibly high, and there's no end in sight for the burgeoning debt. So maybe the elected official voted against health care, but maybe they had a very good reason to do that.
And that's, well, that's a point. Good point, Ken.
I think it's a fantastic point. I think what Chris is saying, and he's absolutely accurate, nothing is really black and white. Nothing is exactly the way it appears. Yes, Congressman Smith voted against the, you know, this bill, but you're absolutely right. There are reasons. There are personal reasons. There are things, well, I hated the bill, but there was something in it I liked, or vice versa. I agree with Chris. Everything is not black and white, even though opponents will try to paint it that way. Chris, that makes a very good point.
Yeah. Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Let's see. Richard in Worthington, Richard Gunther, same one who was involved in helping write the ballot issue to change how districts are drawn in Ohio.
Yes, that's me.
Okay.
Good to be on the show.
You bet.
I'd like to disagree with the interpretation that there was no blue wave in Ohio, because if you take a look at the shift in the vote between 2016 and 2018, there was really quite a considerable shift towards Democrats, and this is particularly the case with regard to the congressional districts. The average shift in the margin of victory was 10.3 points from 2016 to 2018 on average for Ohio's 16 districts. And if you take a look at the 12th district, which was the one that was most critical, there was a 32% shift. That is a huge shift away from Republicans towards Democrats. Similarly, even though Republicans swept all of the statewide races, you take a look at the margin for DeWine over Cordray, and the number of votes that Cordray received. He actually received more votes than Kasich in either of his two elections. So I would like to suggest that it is an exaggeration to argue that there was no blue wave in Ohio. That, in fact, there was significant change, but it was not enough to overcome some of the structural problems of representation that we have in this state.
Fair enough. Yeah. Ken Rudin?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fair. And I actually did notice the fact that many of these statewide races were closer. Some of the congressional ones mm-hmm. were closer as well. But the fact is, look, I know that John Kasich was elected governor in 2010 by, I think, 49% of the vote. I think Bob Taft was elected in 98 with 50% of the vote. Those are low percentages. But the fact is, they won. And yes, you're absolutely right. The numbers are more narrow, certainly narrower than they were in 2016, which right. was a great year for Republicans in Ohio. But sometimes, you know, look, John Kennedy won by the skin of his teeth in 1960, but he won and he was president. So it's nice to say that, you know, in horseshoes, coming close is nice, but it really doesn't matter. And I think maybe if it leads to more Democratic gains and better candidates in subsequent years, that could be a sign of a good thing for the Democrats. But right now, in a year where we're looking at who's going to be the next Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy or Nancy Pelosi, or the Majority Leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell or Chuck Schumer, winning and losing is so crucial. But Richard makes a very good point,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he does. Richard Gunther, thank you so much for giving us a call. We will continue our conversation post-midterm 2018 politics with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking post-midterm 2018 politics today with the host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out Facebook and post a question or a comment there. Ken, what do you make of the president's interpretation of the midterms as very good and all good for Republicans and so forth?
Well, in fairness, I mean, the president did come to the cameras on Wednesday when, of course, the numbers did look better for the Republicans than
right.
they do now. But having said that, I mean, to say that this is a great victory for the Republican Party, you know, and I think there were so many things in that press conference that just boggled my mind.
Yeah.
Not just the assault on Jim Acosta. And look, not everybody likes Jim Acosta mm-hmm. of CNN. And I understand that, although I think he crossed the line. The president crossed the line, you know, regardless. But one, to go on and talk about what a great victory this was. I remember when George W. Bush and the Republicans got clobbered in the 2006 midterms, he said, We got a shellacking, mm-hmm. and we got to work better. We got to change our message and figure things out. But we got a shellacking. There was no acknowledgement of the fact that the Republican Party lost the House. He said, "Well," and then the president listed some of the Republicans who lost because they didn't embrace him.
Yeah, that was
Mike
weird.
Mike Kaufman of Colorado. Too bad, Mike. Mia Love of Utah. Well, you didn't show me love. Goodbye, Mia. It was so like he was almost, you know, he was glad and gloating that the Republicans lost. So that reminds me of just what happened just the other day with when he just tweeted, I think it was yesterday, about President Macron in France, because he had the temerity for, you know, attacking or criticizing the president about calling himself a nationalist. And then he said, well, Macron, you know, he's a failed leader and there's high unemployment and there's immigration is out of control and he's a loser. The fact that he would go after U.S. allies in Germany, in France, in Canada, in Britain, and not say a word about Vladimir Putin or you know, his buddy in North Korea is just, well, I don't even know if astounding is the right word, because you can't say astounding for every day for 2 years and say it's astounding or surprising.
Yeah, I mean, the other issue is, of course, immediately after the election, he fired Jeff Sessions, his attorney general. That's kind of there's been a lot of questions about the acting attorney general, Matthew Whitaker. He's facing a legal battle to keep his new job, although I think a court has ruled overnight that he can keep it, or maybe it was yesterday. Last week, Trump claimed he didn't know Matthew Whitaker. Let's hear what he said.
Well, Matt Whitaker, I don't know Matt Whitaker. Matt Whitaker worked for Jeff Sessions, and he was always extremely highly thought of, and he still is. But I didn't know Matt Whitaker. He worked for Attorney General Sessions.
Yeah.
That's not true. He knows who he is. He's met with him. He's talked to him. I think a bigger thing, rather than a silliness about whether he knows him or not, is that there is a new concern and perhaps jeopardy in the Mueller investigation mm-hmm. because Jeff Sessions recused himself. That's why Rod Rosenstein named a guy by the name of Robert Mueller to head the investigation. But with Sessions gone, we now have Attorney General who will not recuse himself, who will be the new boss of Robert Mueller, and who has said in the past that the investigation is a witch hunt and it's a fraud. And I mean, he also said that the Judiciary Department is overrated. I mean, no, I'm sorry, the judiciary, the courts and the judiciary are overrated. So if you're a president, you want to have an attorney general who speaks for you. But at the same time, you don't want somebody who's a lapdog who just will shut down an investigation in order to protect the president. And Jeff Flake stood up in the Senate yesterday and said, I am not going to vote for any of the president's judges. I think there are 32 federal judges that need confirmation before the end of the year. Jeff Flake, who sometimes shows courage, sometimes less so, but he stood up and said, I am not going to vote for any of them unless there's a bill, they bring forward a bill in the Senate that would protect Robert Mueller's right for an appeal should he get fired. And Mitch McConnell, the last thing Mitch McConnell wants to do is alienate the President of the United States, and by bringing such a bill to the floor of the Senate would really not make Donald Trump very happy.
So do you think Jeff Flake's going to stick to that?
Well, how many times have we asked in the last couple of years, or, you know, will Jeff Flake stick to, look, he always does it, like during the Kavanaugh nomination, he was concerned and he had heart and a break and he got confronted in an elevator by somebody who was sexually harassed. And he says, you know something, I'm going to do something about this. I'm going to demand an FBI investigation. Well, the FBI investigation didn't show anything. And lo and behold, shocking to no one, Jeff Flake voted for Brett Kavanaugh. So, exactly.
Yeah. So let us talk about the Jim Acosta issue, though. CNN is suing the Trump administration to get the White House Correspondents' press pass restored to Acosta after the administration revoked it. The judge was expected to rule today. Any sense about what this means going forward, Ken Rudin?
I don't know. You know, I really don't know. There's a great debate in this country, not so much about Jim Acosta and the way he does his job, but the president and his role. And that's not a bad thing to talk about, but how the president sees the press. Look, we have seen presidents in the past. Richard Nixon had the enemies list. Barack Obama, I think, subpoenaed more journalists than any other president in history. He had more fights and feuds with the press and than anybody since Nixon. So, I've never seen a president. Nobody's ever seen a president calling the press the enemy of the American people, which sounds so Stalin-esque that it's not even funny. And does the press fight back? Is the press outwardly hostile to the president? Absolutely. I've never seen that before either. Mm-hmm. And I think, do I blame Trump for this? I do. Do I think that we the press have been sucked into this battle with him? I do. Mm-hmm. It's not a good thing for us. It breaks my heart that we've become adversaries. And there are some journalists who say, I want to stay above this. I'm not going to, get into the gutter with him. But there are some who just say, look, this is unacceptable and I'm not going to sit silent. So it's a very tenuous time. But the real thing is it's questioning Americans' belief in a free press and the need for a free press. We've seen it in Europe. We've seen it more and more in Poland and Hungary, which are NATO allies. And we've seen it certainly in the authoritarian governments that the president admires. It's frightening. And, Jim Acosta today and maybe somebody else tomorrow, maybe public radio tomorrow. We always talked about how Republicans were going to cut the budget and end public radio funding. Well, it was always a threat, always a concern. It never happened. This is the worst I've ever seen, the most tenuous time for journalism in my lifetime.
Do you think it's fair that people are pointing out his discourse with particularly African-American female journalists at the White House?
But that's what he does. I mean, for example, in the Florida recount, he's going on the assault against the head of voting elections in Broward County in Florida, mm-hmm. who happens to be an African-American female. And his press conference, he'll go after somebody who's African-American women. April Ryan, she'll be dishonest. She'll be a liar. She's a loser. She has low intelligence. Even if it's not blatant racism, there's a tone there. You're looking at what's happening, and even if it's not deliberate, it's there. It's there for everybody to see that he just seems to go after. I was thinking of like Omarosa, and I don't think that she deserves to be part of this conversation.
Yeah.
Right. But there's just so many instances where, reality is the way we see it. I mean, whether it's deliberate or not, it's just not comfortable to watch.
So he's attacking the press. He's attacking the voting system in Florida, especially. And he was attacking the people who manage the forests in California over that horrible fire. that's destroyed the town of Paradise. Now he stepped back from that. Now he's saying they'll give him what. Now this looks like there may be some culpability on the part of the utilities out there, the electric utilities.
Yeah, oh yes.
But
look. Here's the thing, though. Yeah, and there's culpability in the Broward County Department of Elections. There's culpability there too. Mm-hmm. And yes, the utility in California may be at fault, but. But you know, when the nation desperately needs some kind of empathy and some kind of just, you know, leadership or sympathy or whatever feelings from the White House, we got it with Bush after 9/11. We got it with Clinton after Oklahoma City. We got it with Barack Obama with those endless number of shooting deaths of children and churchgoers and everything around the country. Yes. They could have managed the forestry better. The energy company could have been at fault, but my goodness, back then there were only 23 people who perished. Now it's close to 50 or beyond 50.
Beyond, probably.
And I'm looking at videos of charred cars and people dying, burned to death inside. Show some emotion. Feeling, and they were not getting it. And you're not going to teach a dog new tricks. And this is what Donald Trump has done most of his career. And many supporters like him for it. They like the fact that he's just not going to bend to conventional wisdom and being nice. You know, he tells it as it is. And I understand that, and that may be why he got elected, but at some point that has to change. And you know something? One person, one group he has not been attacking lately. Mm-hmm. Is the caravan.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. Yeah.
Every day it was, you know, these Muslims are coming and these M13 gangsters, and they're coming to invade the country, and then we haven't heard from them. Well, geez, since the election we haven't heard from the president mm-hmm. talking about this. I wonder why, but... Mm-hmm. But you know, they're getting closer and closer. I think 800 have reached the border in Tijuana.
Exactly.
There are thousands more coming. Mm-hmm. We'll see if that ramps up as well.
Well, do you think that he will? I mean, was that strictly campaign fodder? And now do you think he will back away from it? Because U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, Homeland Security Secretary Kirsten Nielsen was at the base Camp Donna on Wednesday in Donna, Texas. They're there along with a lot of troops, a lot of National Guard troops.
Right. There were 5,600 troops. Now, the president is talking about 15,000 troops. Yeah. Look, everybody wants a secure border. Everybody doesn't want open borders where thousands of people just marching in saying they want to live here. There has to be a process. But I agree with, I mean, look, if you take a look at what Barack Obama said about illegal immigration when he was running for president, my goodness, those videos are on YouTube. They sound exactly what Donald Trump is saying. So, I mean, some of it is pretty startling when you watch this. Did Barack Obama really say that? And he did. But given the fact that the day he announced his candidacy, he's talking about Mexicans sending in rapists and murderers and filled with crime, the comments he's made about Latinos and Muslims in his 2 years as presidency, it just adds to the ugliness of the rhetoric. But at the same time, you have to have a process. And I think members of Congress on both sides realize that. So do I think the rhetoric is going to ratchet up again? I do. I think as the thousands get closer and closer, I think they will be. But I do think a lot of it was election-related, getting out his base in time for November 6th.
Ken Rudin, we have just a minute left. What are you looking for in the next week?
More depression? No. Obviously, we may have a result in Florida and Georgia, and mm-hmm. it's very possible that the Democrats will not be happy with it. But I would just say, though, that if those votes, a lot of questionable votes, are counted and the Democrats still lose, I think that's a good verdict for the country and a good faith in the system.
Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast, thanks again for joining us. Always appreciate your time.
I love being on the show with you, Ann. Thank you.
That's Ken Rudin, longtime political analyst, former NPR political editor, host of the Political Junkie podcast. He joins us every third Thursday of the month. So remember that. Mark your calendars. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.